Hello, welcome to the Bev Moore Show, live streaming on the iHeart Network and over 185 broadcast stations in 37 countries. I'm your host, Bev Moore. My guest today is an author, composer, songwriter, and producer. Monty Schultz is my guest today. He is the oldest son of the late cartoonist Charles M. Schultz, the creator of Charlie Brown and the rest of the Peanuts Gang cartoons. Coming up, Monty talks about publishing his first novel entitled Down by the River in 1990, and how he spent the next 12 years writing a novel about the Jazz Age. Stay with us. We will be back after the break.
Me when I'm falling, you told me who I am.
interview with Monty Schultz, the son of the creator of Charlie Brown cartoon series, is coming up.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp.
I can probably hit the green from here.
Probably.
Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
I would like to welcome my guest, Monty Schultz. Monty is an author, composer, songwriter, and producer. He published his first novel, Down by the River, in 1990, and spent the next 12 years writing a novel about the Jazz Age. Monty is the eldest son of the late cartoonist Charles M. Schultz, the creator of Charlie Brown and the rest of the Peanuts gang, and he's the owner and teacher of the Santa Barbara Writers Conference. Welcome to the show, Monty.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on it.
Monty, your novel, Metropolis, came out in Fantagraphics in August of 22, which was many years after your first novel, Down by the River, in 1990. Why did you walk away from writing Metropolis for so many years?
Well, I saw an old computer file of it a couple months ago that showed I actually wrote the first part of it in June of 2001. So I have no explanation. It was now it's 22 years ago. So I remember what I wanted to write. I wanted to write a novel with a big theme, big backstory, having a war. And I went away from it because a couple reasons. One obvious thing is I was finishing that Jazz Age novel called Crossing Eden, editing that, and I wrote another true crime novel after that one. And also, at the time, I couldn't figure out how my main character, Julian Bream, a college senior, could be studying the Greeks and the Romans in a completely fictional republic. So I never could sort that out, and I just had to move on to the other books and finish editing them, seeing them published and doing book signings and all of that. And then I decided that I was, in 2016 or so, I was tired of just sitting in front of a computer all the time. So I went back to where I'd started writing, which was with music. And I spent several years doing music and made two CDs and about to finish a third. But in 2019, I realized that music wasn't filling my time. And what was I doing all day? Like nothing. So I decided that I would go back to writing. And I was working on a book called Penny Dreams that I took to Hawaii, where I live half the year. And I got sort of hung up on that book, and I looked at Metropolis in August of 2019 and picked it up exactly where I'd stopped in 2003, and then wrote the entire rest of the book in 9 months. It was sort of miraculous. I had no outline, no plot. I just wrote the book and made it up as I went along. Sort of miraculous.
Wow.
Given how long it is.
It's huge. I mean, that was one of the questions that I had was, how did you write a 60-plus page novel without a plot outline?
Well, okay, so Crossing Eden, the Jazz Age novel, was 1,000 pages, and that took me 10 to 12 years to write, if you count editing and whatever, maybe 15 years. I don't know. It just all came to me, like the muse whispering in my ear for 9 months. I never had any problem writing it. I never had any blocks on it. I had never any part where I didn't know what I was going to do. It just just, I mean, I had issues like that, and it just, they just, everything just came to me. Choose this, write that, write that. I had an interesting writing schedule where I decided that I had to write at least one page in the morning, every morning, before I ate or drank anything. So I'd be very hungry trying to finish the 500 words of the page, whatever it was. And sometimes, a couple times, I remember writing two pages because I had a really good idea. Otherwise, I would finish that page, go eat, you know, maybe run a couple of errands, and come back to the book in the afternoon and write a second, third, or fourth page. And I only missed, so in those 9 months from August till I finished it in April, I believe, of 2020, I only had 3 days I missed, and I was out of town on those 3 days. So I wrote Thanksgiving morning and Christmas morning and New Year's and on my birthday, and I just did it. And the pages add up. So it was 668 pages minus the 50 I had from when I first had written it in 2003. So still, what, you know, 610 pages in 9 months. I don't know. I didn't expect it to be that long. I didn't expect it to be a 400-page book, but the story has its own highway, right? And you follow it.
The twists and turns, exactly. Yeah, and so what interests me was that it was about eugenics. And I wanted to know why you chose to write a novel about eugenics.
Yeah, I suppose the complete answer to that is lost in time from 20 years ago. I would have to look at I have those first pages, the first 50 and some notes on an old Macintosh Mac iBook. And I should look at it and see, was eugenics present in 2003 or 2001 when I first made those saves? I do know that in 2003, I bought a book called War Against the Weak, and it was about eugenics by Edwin Black. But it occurs to me when I realized just a few days ago that the first files were in 2001 and 2003 came along, I realized that I'd already come up with the idea of eugenics, and then buying Edwin Black's book gave me sort of some source material for reference. I didn't read the whole book. I just was skimming through it, looking at this and that. So I just came up with the idea, I guess, because we talk about genocide. Most people talk about genocide as being like the worst thing, but eugenics really, a eugenics crusade is worse because in genocide you can target a certain group of people by race, maybe religion, like Jews, Germany. But in eugenics, you could essentially target anybody you don't like. You just name them as being defective and be removed. And that's what happens in this book. They come up with the idea of eugenics, and then they attach a sort of strange, unexplainable virus called spiriosis to it. Maybe not a virus. And so then they decide, because this is their excuse, and get rid of people. They have this massive testing service, and everybody they don't like goes through the testing service and comes out with spiriosis, and put them on a train and send a million people in the lands to die. But they don't die.
They just weed them out. Yeah, because it really caught my attention, you know, from history. I remember, you know, in the late 19th century, Francis Galton.
Yeah.
I don't know if that rings a bell. Yeah, did the variety of eugenic policies and ensuring that, you know, the health of human species. You know, he was involved in all of that. And that's what rung a bell with me. So I had to go back and look it up and remember what all he did with the immigration restriction and all that. So, that's the last time that I had read about eugenics was with Francis Galton.
Right. Well, I do mention Galton in this book as this character. Adolphus Varan is inspired by the work of Francis J. Galton. So his name is up, and but Galton, the difference, that was in Britain, right? So the difference between the British
in England,
England and us was they wanted to improve the race, make the best people. When it came to America, we wanted to get rid of the what we named as the worst. And that wasn't talking about the blacks and Jews and all that. Actually, it was targeting hillbilly people. They thought they're defective. Right. They were red. Those are the ones that our American Eugenic Society wanted to get rid of. So it's just a different kind of point of view. And ultimately, it ends up eugenics met its downfall at Auschwitz, right? The Germans took over. Our pursuit of people was blocked by the American Census Bureau. And so the whole research of eugenics in America and worldwide eugenics went over to Germany, where the number two in command was a certain Dr. Josef Mengele, which is But as you point out, eugenics was taught in high school and universities. It was accepted as legitimate discipline by Winston Churchill and Henry Ford and Margaret Sanger and a lot many of those.
Right.
It was assumed to be correct, but then we saw ultimately it ends up. And that's kind of what happens in the idea of this book. So anyway, that's where I got the idea.
Well, it makes me want to go and read the whole book, the 600-plus page book. I don't know how long it would take me to read it, but it's got my interest, I would say.
Okay. Well, I have a gardener, my Mexican gardener, and his wife and their four kids come with me to Hawaii. Every year, and last summer, Marcelo's 16-year-old daughter Mia read the whole book in 2 weeks. Actually, three weeks, and her mom too.
That sounds something like I did. Yeah, once I get a hold of a book, I can't stop.
She just I told them, by the way, I said, you guys will not be taking. I had like three copies in the house. And I was keeping one, and the third one, I had already read a third of the book after read for about a week. And so the other one's for Asalia. And I said, so I just want you guys to know you are not taking this book off island. Okay, so you have to finish it. So Asalia finished reading it, she said, at 5 a.m. the morning they were leaving to go back to California. So they both. But I've seen a couple friends of mine here, when they said, I don't know, it seems like a long book. Okay, Mia read it in 2 weeks. She's 16 years old. Okay. Whatever.
That's so fun.
I was proofreading the book. I had to do it four times because I kept being given more time to do it. I read the book four times in 6 weeks. And on one of those readings, the whole book in 5 days. And bear in mind, that's not reading fast. Somebody said, well, you read really fast. No. That's reading, moving my lips. Because I had to see mistakes. So that's how long it really takes less than a week to read. But you have to sort of be, but it's not like I was sitting there for 10 hours either. I just was reading steadily, maybe 30 pages at a time, 50 pages at a time, take a break, read. And so it's not, I mean, the book should not take months to read. It's not that long. So it's fun to read.
Well, that's what I like. I'm definitely, it's on my list. It's on my list. I've got to get the book.
Good.
And then I'm going to brag about it and post it on my pages and make sure other people read it as well.
There's a name that can silence every fear. There's a love that embraces the heartache, the pain, and the tears. Through my faith and my doubting, I know one thing for sure. His word is unfailing, his promise secure. Todo va a estar bien, everything will be alright. Whole world's in his hands, your whole world's in his hands. In the darkness and the trials, he's faithful and he is true. Oh, everything will be alright.
Father, you say everything's gonna be alright, but my circumstances say I won't last through the night. I need your word to hold me now, need you to pull me through. I need a miracle, a breakthrough, I need you. They say you hold the whole universe in your hand, but my world's falling apart like it is made of sand. Am I small enough to slip through the cracks? Can you take my broken pieces and put them back? Give me faith, you believe you're on my side. Open my eyes and see you working in my life. Let the past remind me you never fail. Tell my soul it is well. Oh, y todo va a estar bien. Everything will be alright. The whole world's in his hands. Your whole world's in his hands. In the darkness, in the trials, he's faithful and he's true. Your whole world's in his hands. Y todo va a estar bien.
Te confieso a corazón abierto que todo es muy incierto en este desierto. Mi vulnerabilidad está al descubierto. Siento que mi barca está muy lejos de su puerto. ¿Por qué será que ya no sale el sol en mis días? ¿Por qué mis noches son tan frías? ¿Por qué será que siento que me falta algo? ¿Por qué este camino gris se siente tan largo? Sé que estás sobrando aunque no te sienta. Sé que estás sobrando aunque no te vea. Sé que voy a salir de esta odisea. Sé que voy a ganar esta pelea. Sé que va a cesar esta marea temporaria. Que en ti yo viviré una vida extraordinaria. Y aunque no pueda entender, me consuela saber que
todo, yo sé que todo va a estar bien.
Todo va a estar bien.
Everything will be alright.
The whole world's in his hands. Your whole world's in his hands.
Trials, he's faithful and he's true. Your whole world's in his hands.
You don't know what's out of yet. Oh, 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 everything will be alright.
Everything will be alright.
Oh, 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 yeah.
Don't
know what's out of yet.
Don't know what's out of yet.
Oh, oh, oh,
everything will be alright. Oh.
He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole wide world in his hands.
Todo el mundo en su mano está. Todo el mundo en su mano está. Todo el mundo en su mano está.
My interview with author, composer, songwriter, and producer Monty Schultz continues after the break.
As a veteran, you get a lot of advice. But wisdom's harder to come by. A lot of people imagine themselves in our shoes without understanding the weight on our shoulders. The truth is, few can understand the pressure of finding your own way after serving in the military. But few isn't none. You've got support. You can't control the chaos, but you can chart your way through it. Steady yourself. Take a breath. You're not alone. Learn more at maketheconnection.net.
A model for this book, for this society, for this story, would be if Julian Bream were a college senior at Heidelberg University in Germany in 1943, with the desolation of war occurring in the Soviet Union, and seeing what is happening to it, that society. And it's very similar in that way.
Yeah.
So,
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so anyway, that's sort of what this book is about. I think the true heart of the book. It's also a love story, as it says in the beginning. Let's see. You don't have a copy of the book, do you? So Julian talks about he just wants to tell a love story, and that's what the book is. It's also a love story. It's a romantic love story, and it's a story about the love for people and society.
And that's Julian Bream, right?
Julian Bream, yeah. I call him Bream.
Oh, it's Julian Bream. Here I am with the pronunciation. Okay, yeah. He's the narrator.
Yes, he's the narrator. He's telling this story, what happened.
Right. Mm. Well, I have to do that, and it's a good book to take on a trip to, you know, when you go on vacation or take a long trip.
Mm-hmm. You can also look at the book. My website, it took us like 4 or 5 months to make it going. It's metropolisthebook.com. Metropolisthebook.com, and it has one thing we have in it is a little slideshow showing pictures of some of the locations in the book, you know, that correspond, you know, as much as they can, with a text from the book below each picture. So it's sort of a slideshow of the whole book, mostly.
Oh, wow.
Unless if you look to the very end, you'd see how the book ends, so you're not supposed to do that. But other than that, you can, it sort of gives you an idea, kind of skimming through and getting an idea of what the book is like, how I write. And then there are also little character sketches of the five main characters, and there are lists of foods and institutions and cars and stuff I made up, and then also quotes from the book about love and war and things like that.
It's just got a full variety of everything.
Yeah, it's a really good website. I really like it. It came out. It's how I wanted the website to be. The people who did it for me they didn't want it to be so big, but I said I like websites where there's a lot to look at. So let's see. We have discovery, love. We have war, and we have quotes, and they're all quotes from the books. You know. So here's a good quote. There must be hope, dear, and it needn't appear from the clouds. As we witness these circumstances of our lives, so too are we able to form opinions, to resolve how we absorb them and choose our way forward. Hope is born from that. That's a kind of a lot of philosophy in this book about things. And it's love has no geography. Love has no geography, but what we believe and remember of it. Near or far matters not. The heart may travel, but never leaves. Thank you.
taking all I have, and now I'm laying it at your feet. You'll have every failure, God. You'll have every victory.
More show live streaming on the iHeart Network and over 185 broadcast stations in 37 countries around the world. I'm Bev Moore. My interview with Monty Schultz continues.
I'm Naheem Hines, running back for the Indianapolis Colts and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
Well, your best piece of advice is to read commercial fiction that teaches how to pace a story, while literary fiction can teach how to write better. Can you explain that?
Yeah, okay. So I like commercial fiction books, fun to read. And so a literary writer benefits from reading commercial fiction to really get the idea of pacing and also have stuff happen in the book. I read several books a couple of years ago where they're literary novels and I like them, but basically nothing happened. In a way, the books are kind of boring, but I like them. But and then literary writing, you can see the difference in the language. You can just see. I mean, mm-hmm. the literary just a lot better in their use of language and in illuminating interior ideas. So the best literary writers have really great pacing and great language. I picked up a couple literary books recently. However, commercial books that the story, not, I only read like 5 or 10 pages. Like, no, the writing is boring and the story seems, if they're interesting, I don't know, but I can't read these books. The writing is just plain writing. And some people don't think there is a big difference, but all you have to do is show them literary writing and go, well, okay, yeah, right, the way the language is used. But literary writing is just much better. It's just much better.
Yeah.
So.
And it's all about the pace. It's all about the pace, right?
Yeah. It's just how you say things. It's just more interesting.
And how you say things.
Because, mm-hmm. yeah, the use of language is more interesting. Just sayings, the way things are said, is just more, I don't know, engrossing, I think.
Okay.
It's a choice. It sounds funny, but it's simply, it's just a choice of words. you can just write and you have an idea and you just move along, but literary writers will say things in a way that you wouldn't expect, right? You just would not expect. So that's kind of how I see the difference. So the best literary better.
Which is a lot easier to follow. It's just easier to follow the literary.
No, it's easier to follow the commercial writing.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Sure. But when you're done with the book, you don't feel fulfilled.
You're not as in tune.
Yeah, you just don't see. You don't feel you've read something that's really inspiring. Let's say literary writing is more inspiring. Commercial writing, maybe that's a way to put it. At least language-wise, commercial writing is entertaining, and literary writing is inspiring.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Okay. I get it now. Okay. Right. Well, what books would you recommend for someone who doesn't read?
Oh, that's a good question. But my dad and I used to talk about that. So books have to be, if we're talking to somebody who hasn't read, commercial fiction is fun. A literary novel that sort of is fun to read is Larry McMurtry's Leaving Cheyenne. Is a fun book to read, and it's literary too. Or an older novel, Red Sky at Morning. Contemporary novels, it's hard to pick, because if somebody doesn't really like crime novels, which I like reading, then they're not going to, then that kind of commercial fiction is not going to really appeal to them. An author I like is a Spanish writer, Roberto Bolaño. But then Paul Bowles, another author, has his novel, The Sheltering Sky, is entertaining and literary as well. It's kind of spooky. It takes place in North Africa, Algeria. But,
okay.
Really interesting. Those writers are very good. It's so funny because I have so many books in my...
you do. I can only imagine.
Yeah, I have like 1,000
You have like a library, right?
Yeah, I have a book this house, and I'm always reading at least 2 books at a time. Generally, I read a literary novel first in the evening. Then I watch an episode of one of those streaming series, and then I read the commercial novel last, because it's easier to follow when I get tired, and just kind of page turn.
So
I've been reading the crime writer Michael Connelly, and I read John Sanford, he's another crime writer, and just different people. And the literary writers, I'm just finishing, I'd never read before, Scott Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise, but I'm also reading Brad Easton Ellis's The Shards. I don't totally love it, but it's interesting enough. I have a lot of books. And then I have this book, Roberto Bolaño's book, Antwerp, which is... there's just a whole bunch of like fragments of things that he wrote. So actually pretty easy to read, because they're all just basically on one page. And a lot of different, but ultimately, you know what I really liked was my own book. I really liked Metropolis. It's not always, you have to look at some point.
You have some preference.
Well, ideally you're going to like your own work best, if that's possible.
Of course.
Or at least you're going to like it as much as everybody. You don't want to feel like you're just a fanboy, right, for all your favorite writers.
Right.
Feel that, I think, sort of have a problem, or maybe they recognize they're just not that good. But I don't like anybody's book better than Metropolis. I certainly don't like them as well as my Jazz Age novel, Crossing Eden, which I think is a really objectively great book. In fact, I saw a review of it online somewhere, I don't remember where it was, where they said this book should have won the Pulitzer Prize. And but it just got sort of ignored, which is too bad. It's really interesting. But it takes place in the spring, summer, and fall of 1929, 3 different locations. I liked a lot of, and then, by the way, my novel Naughty is actually really fun to read. There is a book that sort of is the it's a novel based on true story. First 90 pages are fiction; the rest of it's all essentially all true, including a trial transcript I have near the end, which is just verbatim. I just edited it down. But that book is very fun to read. So it's kind of
okay.
It's a commercial novel and a literary novel. Not naughty. The characters are wacky. You know, it's funny to read, but it's all true.
That's why it's called naughty, right?
Yeah, well, that's a hard one to come up with. The quote is from a psychiatrist on the stand talking about her, and they said something about how to treat her. She goes, no, something that she can't be treated. She's naughty, so, it's a weird thing to say, right? That's a psychiatrist, an MD, called her. But she was this really strange person. She
was horrible. Uh-huh.
I love it. There's nothing wrong with me boosting my own book, but there are a lot of books to read. A lot of different books to read that are fun. Also, Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin.
Back, Monty Schultz talks about where to find his book, Metropolis.
which touches on the subject of immigration and a love story.
Before I bring my need, I will bring my heart. Before I lift my cares, I will lift my arms. I wanna know you, I wanna find you in every season, in every moment. Before I bring my need, I will bring my heart.
Hi, I'm Carson Kressley. Of all the most valuable resources in the world, kindness is the most precious. For more than 140 years, American Humane has been working to make the world a kinder place for animals. Rescuing those caught in disasters, protecting animals on our farms, on the silver screen, and the world's remarkable and endangered species who need our care to help them survive. All of us can make a difference by making humane choices at the supermarket, in our choice of entertainment, and by supporting conservation and rescue efforts. It's not hard at all. Make being kind a lifestyle choice and visit AmericanHumane.org for simple ways you can help build a more caring, compassionate, and humane world for animals and for all of us.
Well, let's close with this. The best words of wisdom from your famous father, Charles Schultz. Only amateurs
get writer's block. Professionals can't afford it.
Yeah, that's what he told me once on the phone. I asked him about that. He goes, only amateurs have writer's block. Professionals can't afford it. That's why it's so funny when I interview or I hear writers talk, oh, I was blocked for 8 months. No, you weren't. Come on. I bring this up when I'm teaching the writer's conference or when I speak. I said it's what it really is then is you're either lazy or you're afraid of writing something bad. If you're lazy, that's a problem. So you have to get yourself onto the page. Like Truman Capote said, you have to, put your, it's hard to get into the saddle every day. And that's true. It's to get yourself started. But other than that, I'd say if you're afraid of writing something bad, you're better off with a bad page than no page, because there's going to be something on that page that you might be able to use. And furthermore, once you've gotten that page, now you've moved. Also, sometimes you think, yeah, but the book is going in the wrong direction. Well, then there you go. Now you just learned something. It can't go in that direction. It has to go back. And I've had days here, particularly as I've been writing my new book, Undercity, that I didn't really like what I was writing, and I thought it wasn't very good. And so, but when I revisited the next day, I was like, oh, okay. Most of that's good. And if I cut this, and this, oh, okay, now it reads fine. Okay, now I'm happy with it. All right, that's all it needed. It's just overwritten here or there, or I didn't say that right, or I left something out. So, but you have to take part in your own writing life. You have to, and calling yourself blocked is just a false way to do it. But let's face it. So my dad, as he was right, professionals can't afford it. So if you're a journalist, if you're a columnist, you have to have something in the paper every day. You have to do it. Dad had to have six dailies and a Sunday every week, which he did for over 50 years. So that's why he said there's no. And yes, he had some days where he didn't think the strip was as inspired as others. People would always say, oh, yeah, I like some of them better than others. Okay, well, Dad always laughs about that. You're always going to say that. Okay, it works in life, right? You go to 50 restaurants and you're going to say, oh, I like them all. Even if you eat the same restaurant 20 times in a row, you're going to say a couple times it was better than others, and a couple times it wasn't quite as good. I can have the same thing at a restaurant 10 times. It's never going to be exactly the same. So that's what it's
right.
But the analogy is then, but you still have to take part. You have to eat. You have to write. Okay. So there's no such thing as writer's block. It's just a phony thing. I laugh every time I hear about it now. Let me talk. They're so earnest about it. We just know it's a fact. And the non-writers accept this fact, that thing of writer's block. No such thing.
And we've heard it from the best.
Yeah, exactly.
Handed down from generation to generation. There we go. Absolutely. I hear you. Well, I must say, before we finish off completely, tell us how we can find your books and you, information on you.
So, you can get the book on, it's on Amazon, but you can get it on, you can get it at local bookstores too, which is the best if you can. Have them order it, local bookstore, independent bookstore. But you can also go to metropolisthebook.com and order the book right there. It's available. So I suppose send me contacts through that.
Perfect.
That good. Yes enough.
Perfect. Well, Monty, I thank you so much for being a super guest on the Bev Moore Show. You've been fabulous.
Thank you.
Yes, you have. And we wish you continued success.
Get people to buy the book. Buy the book.
Okay. Well, I will promote it for you. I will do that for you. How about that?
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed my interview with author, composer, songwriter, and producer, Monty Schultz, who is also the son of the late cartoonist Charles M. Schultz, the creator of Charlie Brown and the rest of the Peanuts Gang cartoon series. Thank you for listening to the Bev Moore Show, broadcasting on BBS Radio on the iHeart Network worldwide. I'm Bev Moore. Until next time, Bye-bye.
When the best of me is barely breathing, when I'm not somebody I believe in, hold on to me. When I miss the light, the night is stolen. When I'm slamming all the doors you've opened, hold on to me. Hold on to me. Hold on to me.